This time of the year, we always start focusing in on the biggest stories in the world of sports. We continue our countdown this morning. We started out our top 10 stories in the world of sports last Friday with the number 10 story being Kevin Ward Jr., who was tragically killed in a car accident at a sprint car track in upstate New York by a car that was driven by Tony Stewart. The number 9 story, of course, was the controversy surrounding the Washington Redskins name. The number 8 story, which continues to play itself out, was the Adrian Peterson saga in the National Football League. And story number 7 comes up this morning. Story number 7 involves a football player who was a little different than everyone else, and it seemed to scare everyone off. And joining us right now on the Horace Nissan Fox phone lines, our next guest, he is the editor of Outsports.com, one of the leading publications in the world on the coverage of sports from the gay and lesbian perspective. And joining us right now is the editor of that publication, Sid Ziegler. Sid, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Sid, let's go back a few months here to when we got the first announcement and when we knew Michael Sam had come out, and there was the inherent fear of, you know, what does this mean for the sports guy and, you know, the macho sports guy who couldn't handle, you know, oh, we can't have this in the world of sports. We can't have this in the football locker rooms. Talk about your perspective from that when that story first broke.
Well, you know, I was one of the people who wrote that one of those first stories.
Right.
They released it on the New York Times and ESPN and Outsports at the same time, and I had been helping his team and to figure out what the strategy should be, how he should come out. And my first feeling was that this was just all of the stuff about the fear and the anxiety of having a gay man in the locker room was totally overblown. I've told the story of couple hundred gay athletes over the last 15 years, and every single time it's the same thing. There's a bunch of fear and anxiety, and what will people say, and what will people do. And then when they come out, all of that fear and anxiety was shown to be unwarranted. So I knew all the nonsense about the locker rooms just wasn't true.
Did you approve of the way they did the story of him coming out? Did you think they should have handled it differently? Do you think that his people should have handled it differently, or did you think it was done appropriately?
I thought it was great. You know, Michael's people came to us and said that he wanted to come out before the draft, that he wanted to be drafted by someone who wanted him, that he didn't want to have to deal with the anxiety that he felt internally the way he had to while he was closeted at Missouri. And he also felt that so many people already knew that it was going to come out eventually. You know, with TMZ running around with their cameras, somebody would have gotten whispers and then shown up at the wrong place at the wrong time and asked, you know, dumb questions. So he wanted to get ahead of it, and I thought that the way that it was done was classy and smart.
We're talking to Sid Ziegler. He's the editor of Outsports.com, joining us here on Fox with complete coverage of the sports story number 7 of 2014, the story of Michael Sam and his quest to become the NFL's first openly gay football player. Sid, I want to get your thoughts on some of the controversy that surrounded Michael Sam and the way some of his people handled matters as far as marketing him were concerned. There were the stories that came out about a television show, a reality television show that was going to be programmed by Oprah Winfrey on her television network, and a lot of people thought that Michael Sam and his people were using this not just as a tool to increase awareness, but were also using it as a tool to increase marketability and to, in turn, you know, profit from all of this. What did you take from the story regarding that?
Well, those people were totally wrong. What Michael's people were trying to do is make their client some money and build a bit of an insurance policy. You know, at the time when they started talking to Oprah Winfrey, there was no guarantee that Michael was going to play in the NFL. A lot of people felt that this was still going to hurt him. And you know, what a great opportunity if you're an agent to get some kind of an insurance policy with a deal for a TV show with Oprah Winfrey. It was very, very smart, and it was thinking about Michael's future. But of course, a bunch of nasty, mean-spirited sports reporters decided that a couple cameras were going to somehow distract him from his ability to make the team. Well, Michael performed very well in the preseason. He was fourth in the NFL in sacks. He was second on the team in tackles. His best game was the one against Johnny Manziel that people were talking about in the preseason.
Right.
And guess what? The cameras were there. So all of that nonsense was totally unfounded, and it was disappointing to see from smart people in football.
Sid, do you think that somehow, because of his status, Michael Sam was the co-SEC Defensive Player of the Year. Seven of the past eight of those same players were drafted in the first round of the NFL draft. Michael Sam, however, was taken with the second-to-last pick in the seventh and final round of the 2014 NFL draft. Why do you think there was such a disparity between those other seven SEC defensive players? Welcome back. It's hour number two. It's First Sports of the Morning on Fox AM 1340, 93.9 FM. In the midst of World Cup fever, of course, tomorrow, the United States taking on Belgium. Got to look back at yesterday's two dramatic victories yesterday by the Netherlands and Costa Rica. So we'll have continuing coverage of the World Cup coming up later on this hour. But right now, we're focusing our attention on Major League Baseball, where yesterday, my beloved Los Angeles Dodgers finally got even with the San Francisco Giants, just percentage points behind the Giants right now for first place in the National League West, but also talking about a brand new book and a really, really amazing read also. Hal Bodley, former baseball editor of USA Today. He served as a broadcast analyst for several television networks. He's the author of several books and the author of a brand new book called How Baseball Explains America. Joining us right now on the Horace Nissan Fox phone lines is Hal Bodley. Hal, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for spending some time with us and being a baseball guy. I guess just a couple of quick questions about some of the stories you've been watching this season. Obviously, big things happening in the NL West right now. The Giants falling apart, and once again, the Dodgers making that big move from like they did last year when they were trailing the Giants by a bunch of games, then made that big move. Don Mattingly seems to have that thing where as long as he puts his foot down a little bit, the Dodgers seem to respond.
Hey, Steve, was there ever any doubt about the Dodgers? I mean, we thought the Giants were going to go run away and hide and, you know, celebrate the pennant, but really they've come back to the pack. They've had a tough go. And I felt all along that sooner or later the Dodgers would, you know, move into first place because this is an awesome team from top to bottom. So it's obviously happened. You asked me about some of the other surprises. I didn't think Milwaukee would be as far away from St. Louis as it is right now. The Tampa Bay Rays, hey, Steve, I picked them to win the World Series
right
this year, and they are really struggling. They're the Toronto Blue Jays of this season, because last year it was Toronto everybody thought was
going to. And it's funny because that division is so topsy-turvy. I still think Baltimore wins that division. Everyone's got a team in that division. Even the Yankees are still very much in the hunt of the American League East. I still think that division is as wide open as it is frustrating.
Well, you know what, Steve? I think that division tells us an awful lot about baseball in 2014. There are no really great, great teams out there. I mean, there's a lot of parity. I mean, one week it's this team leading the division, the next week it's another team. I've seen a lot of bad baseball this year. I'm sure you have too. And it's really very, very, parallel to the type of season that we're seeing.
No question about it. Hal Bodley joining us here on Fox. Hal, first off, congratulations on this book. This is a really amazing read, and there are some things about the book I want to get your thoughts on and kind of give our audience a chance to expound on a little bit as well. A couple of portions of the book here, in particular, there's a whole chapter in here about George Steinbrenner, but before that, there's a chapter in here about owning a team and the difficulties of owning a team, but the almost instant attraction that billionaires seem to have to wanting to own a team.
Well, they want to be a member of the fraternity. I mean, they want to, you know, they want to buy in, so to speak. They've been very successful in business, built up a fortune, obviously, to afford a baseball team. They get in there and they find it's not quite as easy as it was in their other endeavor. You can think of Ray Kroc with the San Diego Padres and Ted Turner. It goes on and on and on. It's happened an awful lot. It takes a certain type of person. I think you have to be a baseball person to own a baseball team. And a lot of these owners, if they have taken over, spent the money, bought the franchise, and let a baseball person run it, it seems to work. But I write in the book about the time that Ted Turner didn't like Dave Bristol, his manager, so he decided to manage the ball club until the commissioner stepped in and said, you can't do it. And, of course, in San Diego one night, the Padres weren't playing very well, and Ray Kroc went to the this is really a funny story. Went to the microphone and apologized for the play on the field. And about at that moment, a streaker went across the outfield and he yells into the microphone, "Get him, get him, get him." This is the owner of the San Diego Padres. And of course, years ago, Wrigley of the Cubs decided it was not good to have one manager. He decided to have his board of coaches. And before Don Zimmer died recently, we talked about how crazy that was to, you know, run in a different coach every so often to manage the ball club. So, you know, it was a lot of fun to do this book because I've seen an awful lot of baseball.
And, of course, we're talking with Hal Bodley. He's the author of How Baseball Explains America. And then there's the other side of ownership, and that's George Steinbrenner. And whether you are a Yankees fan or a Yankees hater, George Steinbrenner came to define baseball, really, to a generation of fans and people who followed the business of baseball. And he was a guy who, despite his original statements of that he wasn't going to be a hands-on owner, he was everything but a hands-off owner, that's for sure.
No problem there. I mean, you're accurate. I remember on January the 3rd, 1973, I was in New York City, and Steinbrenner was paying $8.7 million to buy the New York Yankees from CBS. And at that press conference, he said he was going to be an absentee owner.
Here. Roland Lazenby is the author of the critically acclaimed bestseller Jerry West, The Life and Legend of a Basketball Icon, among numerous other books. He spent the past three decades interviewing NBA players, coaches, and staff members while writing about the league. He lives in Virginia, and he is also the author of a brand new book, and it is an amazing read. It is Michael Jordan, The Life. It is not a sit-down and a half-an-hour read. It is an epic, and it follows the life of one of the greatest basketball players, if not the greatest basketball player in the history of the NBA. And joining us right now on the Horace Nissan Fox phone lines is the author of Michael Jordan, The Life, Roland Lazenby. Roland, good morning. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me on your show, Steve.
Appreciate it very much. I want to get to what inspired you to do this particular book. Obviously, you've covered so many great players. What inspired you in particular to do this book?
Well, I spent a lot of the 1990s writing about the Bulls. I spent a portion about Jordan and the Bulls. I spent the 80s writing about the ACC and then also about the Pistons who were opposing Jordan's teams. So I had a great fascination. I'd often wondered, where does a guy like this come from? Here's a guy who just dominates the planet with his persona and all this talent. Where does someone like this come from? Who were his people? And so that sort of drove me to really find out who his people were.
There are three portions of this book. There's about 71, actually, but there's three in particular that I wanted to talk about with you this morning because they're fascinating portions of the book. One of them is about the relationship between Michael Jordan and the folks from Nike and how they interwork and all the interworkings there, including the relationship with Sonny Vaccaro, because that was a fascinating portion of the book.
Thank you. It was. And, of course, Sonny was great to me. Spent mountains of time explaining things and all the developments behind the scenes. And, you know, Michael Jordan's mother played a large role in getting him that Nike contract. And Sonny Vaccaro's intuition, they give Michael this fabulous contract that no other athlete has ever had before he even plays a single NBA game. It's amazing.
We're talking to Roland Lazenby. He is the author of Michael Jordan, The Life, here on Fox AM 1340, 93.9 FM. Roland, before we get to another portion of the book, I did want to give you a chance to comment. I know that there was some misunderstanding, I believe it was, among some members of the media about some quotes that were in your book or quotes that have come out in recent weeks regarding Michael Jordan's relationships growing up in the high school environment where he didn't like white people. Let's just put it that way. And obviously, in light of what's been going on in recent weeks here with the Donald Sterling scandal, I know that was not necessarily a conversation that you had with Michael Jordan in this particular book, but talk about that a little bit and how he did grow up, you know, in that kind of an environment.
Right. He actually made that comment in 1990 to Playboy magazine. And Playboy, that was published at the time, but there was no Donald Sterling incident. A British tabloid, and those guys just know how to go for the jugular in terms of popular culture. they did a story, a big spread on my book. They did a big story, they really highlighted that quote in terms of Donald Sterling because Jordan, like so many other people, had just spoken out about the Sterling incident. And that ignited a media firestorm. I was using the quote in the context of the time. Jordan was going through a difficult time as a 14-year-old. A lot of things had happened to him personally, to his family. And he was just being honest in 1992, discussing how he felt in that portion of his life. And, of course, the other part of the quote is that his mother and his family, thank you, helped him through that. And, you know, he obviously, there's probably no other American who has a more integrated life, a more racially diverse life than Michael Jordan.
Roland Lazenby, I'm sorry. Go ahead, finish your thought. I apologize.
They blew.